G'day, it's Daniel Harford. Welcome to the Best of the Breakfast Club on RSN 927. It was jam-packed. Check it out.
Whitey, good morning.
I know it's a calorie-deficient day. I know that much. So not much to look forward to throughout the course of the day, but that's okay. I'll have my saladas at lunchtime, and I'll have my vegetable soup at dinner time, and that will be it. And maybe a piece of fruit.
Talk me through the salada situation while we're there. What's on the salada? And is it the full square of four, or are we snapping it in two and having two twos? No, so how do you play this?
Two squares of four with a piece of ham on it.
That's it?
That is it.
No pickle?
I can have a glass of water.
No salt pepper?
But that's it. No.
Just ham?
That's it.
It's got a piece of tomato?
Not a lot to look forward to. No.
Why can't you have tomato?
No. Well, you probably could, to be honest, but I'm not really a massive fan of tomato. I love tomato sauce, but I don't really like tomato. So,
really?
I mean, I'll have it, but I don't love it.
Tomato's
so that's my day. So when you know when that's sort of, that's ahead of you, it's not really anything to get too excited about. I will tell you, though, that today's a millage day.
Oh.
Because, I don't know, I actually got woken up by some very heavy rain at about 4 o'clock this morning. Looking in the gauges around town, only 5.4 in the city gauge, but in other areas, the airport 13, Coldstream 9, Essendon 6.6, up in the Dandenongs 12, Geelong 11.6, Laverton 10.6, down to Scoresby 8.6 and Viewbank 8. And sort of the Mornington Peninsula, I've got a reading for Frankston, 7. Now, we're racing at Mornington today, so it's amazing how often it rains when there's races at Mornington. Anyway, and there's a lot more to come. So, yes, interesting. That's about as interesting it gets for me on a calorie-deficient day. Keeps my mind off eating.
Well, probably not a great day to do this, but there was a story that did catch my attention overnight, Whitey, and I didn't know it was a calorie-deficient day, but I teed up the story. So my apologies,
right. I'm
but I think you're interested in it.
You can throw whatever you want at me, as long as it's not KFC.
Righto, I'm in trouble. Because there's a dude. What's his name? Does he have a name? Seamus Murphy. Now, Seamus is a tradie. He's big on the TikTok these days. Now, are you across the TikTok?
Right. No, well, I know what it is, but there's no chance I'm ever doing any of that sort of activity.
Well, now, you're thinking of the sort of template dancing to the little tune TikTok. TikTok's also just a way of communicating, like Snapchat or Facebook Messenger or whatever it might be.
I just ring someone up and talk to them.
Well, yeah, but you can't get the masses. You can't have the masses. 100,000 people just watching your everyday movements. Anyway, I digress. Seamus, my man, the tradie, has decided that he would partake in a challenge, a 100-day challenge. And every day of that 100, he would post himself eating a Zinger box from KFC.
What's in a Zinger box?
Well, I'm glad you asked, because I didn't know that either. But the story tells me, which is fantastic. A KFC Zinger box is a popular meal that includes a Zinger burger, 3 wicked wings, regular chips, a potato and gravy, and a soft drink. Now, he's going to do that every day for 100 days. He's up to day 44. And he documents this on his TikTok.
Nice.
So it's an unusual challenge, I must admit. I can't think it's going to be overly good for his cholesterol or his other health issues that I can't quite think of at the moment. It's 4,865 kilojoules per box. Now, that's more than half the recommended daily intake for an adult male. So there's not much left over once he's got through the Zinger box. Is that something that appeals to you post-challenge or post-5-2 situation that you're running yourself through at the moment? Could you see yourself getting through a Zinger box a day?
Well, I'm not a Zinger fan. I'd just have to be the fillet. I don't like the spicy stuff. So, I've been known to go to an establishment and get a takeaway burger, bring it back and start eating it for it to be a zinger, not a fillet, and having to take it back and get a different one. I've no trust in our local KFC. They do some strange things. I've told you before, I've come the whole way home without the chicken in the burger.
Oh, boy.
No, I'm serious. I've told you that before. And you sit there, you unwrap it, and you think there's a lack of body to it, and realise that they haven't put the fillet in. And then you sit there and you stare at the burger, and you go, I've got a 7-kilometre trip back to KFC to right the wrong here. Do I do it? Well, of course you do. It's a KFC burger. But I wouldn't have the zinger situation. But I shouldn't admit to these things. But I've done a test match before where I've had 5 different consecutive days of takeaway food. In the holidays. But 100 days. That's like that movie. With the McDonald's movie. Yeah.
Yes. Well, he's halfway through, effectively. On day 19, he tells us, he'd only gained 1 kilogram. Now, it's only 55% of the daily intake, so he's still got a few calories up his sleeve. But
yeah, if he's a tradie, though, he's very active as well.
Oh, I would imagine.
Which makes it easier to keep the weight off.
It would cost him...
Yeah.
1,000 over 100 days, which is, what, a 3-month period, just over 3 months, $1,145. That's expensive lunch for 3 months.
Yeah, interesting. Interesting. I remember that Super Size Me movie, and because I was in my very, very early 20s, maybe even late teens, early 20s when that movie was announced, and a mate of mine and I... We were a bit bored, and we said, oh, we should get ourselves to 100 kilos and then see how long it takes to take that weight off. Yeah,
that's
just something to do. And I remember turning to my mate and saying, there is absolutely no way in the world I could get to 100 kilos. No chance. It'd be impossible to get to 100 kilos. Wow. How wrong is Adam? I got to 100 kilos without even trying.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Wow.
Oh, goodness me. Goodness me. Well, you've achieved it. Well done. Just got to take it. Look,
yeah.
How long it takes to
and
get
you know
it off
what?
Now.
It's a lot harder to get off than I thought.
Wow. off the SMS, half Whitey could do a 100-day salada and ham challenge. That doesn't sound like much fun to me.
No.
Another one backing that up, or same theme. What kind of freak has ham on salada?
Well, you got to mix it up. It's not something I would do under normal circumstances, but you get a bit of sort of protein. You get a bit of protein from that.
What about a bit of tuna? One of those flavoured tunas?
No.
Why not? No. It's delicious.
No. There's a text here that says that silliest diet ever, the 5-2. It's not. It's actually not. It's actually a very good diet, and it's been given all the ticks and all that sort of stuff. So, and it works. And I'll be serious for a moment. I'm into my what am I into? Week six.
Six.
No, sixth week, and I have lost. 6 kilos, and I'll even be this honest to say that I have lost 11 centimetres around my waist in 6 weeks.
Which is what, 4 inches?
So, yeah, just, yep. So,
4 inches.
It works.
It's good.
It does actually work, and it has other health benefits as well. So, it was that Michael Mosley diet that he's got a couple of variations of it, but... On a Monday and a Thursday, I have 500 calories, or you can have up to 600 calories. But it's really worked, and I'm doing other things as well, physical exercise and whatever else. But I've always been pretty good with that. But I just have never been able to lose weight well, easily. But it's working. So anyway, that's enough of that. Yes, let's talk about my favourite topic, Essendon.
Well, my understanding is the Essendon millage that
you
read out
at the moment.
You read out before the Essendon millage. Was that all the Bombers fans crying over their club being in total disarray? Because one of the great things I've enjoyed in the last couple of days, Whitey, is a bit like the but when we get off air and we have our post-show meeting and we get the numbers through for the COVID numbers of how many COVID positives they've had for the day. It's getting a bit that way with Essendon. How many players have left today? It's a bit like that.
No, it's not.
It's a bit like that at the moment. How many today for the Bombers? What's happening over the Euro Club? What have you done to them?
Well, you see, I actually think it's not a bad thing. And now I'm, you know, you might be say that's silly. I mean, Joe Danaher has hardly played any footy now for what, 3 years or 2 years? I think it's 3 years he's been
close enough to three,
affected by it. So, and there's been some conjectures to whether he wants to stay or not. And I think that he's put the club in a bad light now for quite a while. The Adam Saad one was a surprise, and I think that's clearly a setback for us. And he's only been at the club 3 years, fourth in the best and fairest, then third and third. He gets offered a pretty good deal to stay, and he chooses to go to Carlton on a similar sort of deal. Maybe Carlton offered a little bit more. But, you know, if Orazio Fantasia goes, well, he was going to go last year anyway. Isn't this a sort of a line in the sand opportunity for Essendon to say, right, you're either with us or you're not? And I think I said this yesterday. And they've got a great opportunity to do that now. They're going to be armed with good picks. Now they can either keep those picks or they can trade those picks. At least they now know, because I reckon Danaher and Saad have been almost holding the club to ransom over the last couple of weeks. There's been a hell of a lot said about them negatively over the last couple of weeks. Now they can draw a line in the sand and actually start to sort of move forward. So my comment on Essendon half is it actually almost doesn't matter what has happened to this point. It's actually what happens now, because there's a new coach that is fully in charge. They're going to bring another assistant coach in. I don't know who that's going to be, but they'll bring another assistant coach in to help Ben Rutten. And it's like, right, this is the new era of Essendon. There are concerns from the constituency, the Essendon constituency, about Ben Rutten because of what had happened this year. But I think you've got to judge Ben Rutten on what happens next year, not necessarily what has happened this year, because he's now got full control and there's no excuse. So that would be what I would say about Essendon.
Well, they came out swinging yesterday, the Bombers, on a bit of a media barrage. Dan Richardson, the footy manager, was out and about. But this is from the Essendon website. Let's have a listen to Richo.
I don't really see it as a player exodus. I mean, Joe had one foot out the door last year, and I think we've done. You know, I think he ended up facing a really difficult decision, and we understand that it was a 50-50 decision for him. So I think as the year went on, he probably became more likely to stay than go, even though he clearly made that decision this time last year. So each individual situation needs to be taken on its merits. I mean, Adam's a different case altogether, and clearly he's had a compelling offer from another club, which he's chosen to pursue. So, it's difficult to do much about that. And in terms of the case for Raz, look, at this point in time, he hasn't requested a trade. But, look, we know that family are very dear to Orazio, and we know that there's a strong connection with his family, and there's, you know, he's been open about the pull back home to Adelaide being strong over the years. But, you know, at this stage, he hasn't requested a trade home. And if he does, then it could be one of those situations that it's, you know, the best thing by both parties to consider that. But look, we'll only consider that if that discussion takes place, which it hasn't today. Don't consider this a rebuild. There's an opportunity there to obviously gain, and you know, that will be in the form of a mix between some early draft picks, which we haven't had for a number of years, and it will be also potentially in the form of some really strong recruits that we can bring in via the trade period.
Essendon footy boss Dan Richardson there, talking about the situation with Joe and Adam and Raz, Orazio Fantasia, and also talking about the state that they find themselves in and what they're calling it. They're certainly not calling it a rebuild. What? It's not a full rebuild. It's not North Melbourne, but it's building again. If you're going to the draft with picks, you're building, aren't you?
Well, maybe. But I do think it's not. It wouldn't be a full rebuild. No. It has the potential to be a renovation, but it depends. As I said, it depends on what they choose to do. And I think that, you know, again, Essendon's going to be, I believe, Essendon's going to be on trial based on what they do now. Now, I've said this a number of times, and I'll say it again because I think it's been proven to be correct. Essendon needs on-field leadership. They need experienced on-field leadership. And I know that, you know, in a lot of quarters, and we might even try and get this man on today or tomorrow, but there were so many people that were, you know, wanted to criticise Brendan Goddard for the way he was at Essendon. Brendan Goddard was a strong leader at Essendon, an on-field leader that demanded high. He had high expectations, and he came from a successful environment. Now, it wasn't a premiership environment, but he came from a successful environment, and he was forever frustrated that the bar wasn't set high enough from their on-field leaders. And he started to set higher standards at that football club. Now, he left, and they didn't try and fix that area. And I just think if you look at Essendon's leaders, they just need stronger people that have come from successful environments to help set better standards on the field. Because that is, I think, their biggest issue.
So where does that come from? They're going to draft and getting experience and leadership.
But you got to go and get them. I mean, part of the reason why Brisbane was able to bounce as quickly as it did was because it got Luke Hodge in there, who said, right, boys, this is how you do it. Because he had done it. And I think that there is an element of that's exactly what Essendon needs. Now, okay, they don't grow on trees and they're not necessarily easy to get. That's what they need to do. So that's where Ben Rutten, I'll go and get him another assistant coach or go and get this, go and get that. He needs on-field leadership to help him be able to get through to the players what he wants. And if Ben Rutten says, right, Adam Saad, you're going to do this because this is going to be what we need you to do for the team. And he says, no, I want to go and run and bounce and I want to go and do this and that. And then someone says, well, no, we want you to be a team player. And then he cracks the Saads and wants to leave.
Oh, so this is good. This is like not playing for now yesterday now crack the Saad. You've had two good
now,
days.
I'm not saying that that's what happened, but that's what's been reported. But that's when you need on-field leadership to be able to say to Adam, mate, we're not interested in this and this. We're interested in this because if you do this, if you buy into this, this will get you, you know, preliminary finals. This will get you grand finals because this is what I did. Now, they've got none of that. Outside Jake Stringer, there is, I hope this is right, outside Jake Stringer, there's no real premiership experience in that group. Now, Dylan Schill and Devin Smith have made Essendon better, but they don't have premiership experience. They need to go and get that. You know, go and raid Sydney. Go and raid Hawthorn. Go and raid Geelong. Go and do something to get someone in there that can actually start to set the standards on the field. Because I reckon that's where Essendon's been let down in recent times. They've got some good players and they've got some good leaders, but go and get some great leaders.
Is James Kelly set high standards. Still at Essendon?
He is, but he's a coach. He's not a player.
Well,
but he's there. It's helpful.
But is this worrying about outcomes as opposed to going to the root problem of culture?
Or but is isn't this that, going to fix it? Isn't that how you fix culture?
But that's on an on-field perspective, perhaps, and that would transfer, no doubt, to the carryings-on outside of that. But isn't there a bigger issue here? Isn't the environment that's been created not conducive to team? Seemingly what we're hearing is it's not an environment that's conducive to team, or they've been allowed to run their own shops to a degree, and then you get anarchy, and then it all breaks down like seemingly has happened.
Absolutely, but there's this feeling now. I reckon it's so easy. It's a culture in Australian football, AFL football. I just blame the coach, blame the coaching team, and all this sort of stuff. Now, obviously, they have to take some semblance of responsibility, but I reckon playing groups always get off lightly in that situation. At the end of the day, when you're out there and you're three goals down, this is
seemingly it's more than the footy department. This is a club issue at the moment.
You know what has to happen is from the president the whole way down to the 42nd player on the list, there needs to be alignment. And I'm not sure that there's been alignment for a while. And a lot of that goes down to half. They haven't had success for such a long period of time now. They are restless. They are impatient. And I think a lot of the time, not everybody's on the same page. And if you want to have success, you have to have everyone on the same page.
No doubt. But that's a good... So why hasn't that been happening? And who hasn't been driving that? They're the questions I'm asking to get to the point where it becomes like this. That's my concern with the Bombers.
Yeah,
and I actually like what Dan Richardson said a couple of times yesterday in some interviews, and I know we're going to get to the break, where he said, well, Ben Rutten's demanding new standards, and if you can't keep up to them or falling behind them, then go somewhere else. That's the sort of commentary I would like to hear more of.
I agree.
Saying, if you're not with us, you're against us, get out. We don't want you.
I agree.
And if you are here and you are going to commit, then you're all in. That's the conversation I would like to hear from Essendon, and publicly.
Yeah, I agree with you. And that's, you know, it's up to them. As I said, it doesn't matter what's happened in the past. We can talk about the supplements, and we can talk about all this, and we can talk about Essendon's never been the same since Kevin Sheedy got sacked. That all might be true, but it's kind of irrelevant as to what happens now. They've got to make a stand. And they talk about being ruthless. They talk about this, and they talk about that. Go and do it. Go and be it. And then live it. But
we'll
I think you have to get a couple of people in there that actually do live it. You can't talk it if you haven't got the people that can do it.
I wonder if Lucas Herbert's been to Wally World. He's had a good time the last couple of weeks in the theme park. And, of course, Carl Spangler in Caddyshack was another of... that was Bill Murray's character in Caddyshack. And Ty Webb was Chevy Chase's character in Caddyshack. And I'm sure Lucas Herbert's seen plenty of Caddyshack through the journey. He's had a good couple of weeks and he joins us on the Breakfast Club. Good morning, Lucas.
Hello, boys. Yeah, Caddyshack's definitely been on the rotation in the numerous amounts of hotel rooms I've had to hang out with in the last few weeks. But I thought I'd just...
Hey, Wayne, what's with the pictures?
To Sam, whilst I'm here, I hope the latte tastes disgusting.
Righto. Fair enough, too. Fair enough, too. Hey, where are you? Because we spoke to Scotty Hend yesterday and he hadn't seen you getting ready for the BMW PGA Championship. Where are you?
I snuck in very late. I am here in London. I'm at the hotel 10 minutes away from the course, but the bubble for me feels a bit like jail, so I'm trying to avoid it as much as possible. So when we get let out on Sunday night, I get out of there and I get away and have a few days to myself to sort of chill out and escape from life on tour a little bit. And then I've been rejoining basically Tuesday night each week. So right. Feel like I get a bit of a weekend and then, yeah, come back in, get a day of practice and ready to go.
So what can you do in those 2 days? Like, obviously, do you have to... is there still some discipline to staying away from normal people to stay in that COVID bubble? Or do you have to... Or can you do whatever you like?
Yeah, look, it's a bit tricky because I'm not even sure what a lot of the laws are in... I've been in Northern Ireland, England, Scotland, variously in the last 3 weeks. And... they've all got different laws around, obviously, COVID restrictions and the amount of people you're allowed to see at one time or anything like that. So, I've just tried to obviously be pretty sensible with it and just I've caught up with a few friends in that time and hung out a bit. But, I mean, it's pretty important that I obviously stay COVID-free because I need to get a test every week and test negative. So, the rules can be kind of as strict as they like. I've still got to actually behave myself and not get the virus myself.
Well, it's you've going in on a bit of an extraordinary run at the moment. Even since we last spoke to you, where you felt that you were going to play well in Ireland, that you finished inside the top 10, tie for 7th, and then a tie for 4th in the Scottish Open, and Half and I have both been watching way too much of you and not getting a lot of sleep. You're really feeling it, and which is amazing considering how little golf you've played, you know, going into this little stretch. Are you feeling it? How good do you feel about your game at the moment?
Obviously, yeah, the results kind of speak for themselves there. The last couple of weeks have been really good. The last 3 weeks, obviously finishing 31st at the US Open is kind of unimpressive as 31st sounds. I was actually very proud of that result. So, my last 3 weeks have been really good. I've hit my irons quite well, which I think is basically for me, when I hit my irons well, it seems to be the weeks that I play well. The rest of it all stays pretty consistent through the rest of my game. So, yeah, that's obviously been great. I've made some really good swings. Be able to give myself some pretty good chances to make birdies and get towards the top of that leaderboard. So, it's been good.
And it's been nice to watch, I must admit. But I did after the US Open experience, where it was tough for everyone, and as a viewer and as a hack golfer myself, you think, gee whiz, how would I go on that course? But then I asked myself the same question on Saturday at Royal Aberdeen, wherever you were playing, the Renaissance Club. Why playing those conditions on Saturday, Lucas, where it was horrendous. The rain was coming in sideways. It would have been freezing cold. It would have been gloves and towels and shoes going everywhere after the game with all your wet weather stuff. How was that to play in? And have you played in conditions like that in recent times?
I think that was probably the worst conditions I've ever played in from a rain perspective. The forecast was 100% chance of rain the entire day, so we knew we were in for something there. I think it was actually it was hard to dress for because you obviously want to try and still have freedom to swing the golf club, but you want to also stay as dry as possible. So I had four layers on the bottom. I had like tights on. I had tracksuit pants on underneath my rain pants, and when I finished the round, obviously took just everything off in the locker room because I did have some dry spare clothes there, and basically down to underwear. It looked like I just jumped in the pool. Everything was soaked. I probably got through. We had three towels in the bag. I think we got through 12 holes, and all three were soaked. Absolutely no good to us. So, I think six gloves went missing that day, and are probably never going to be good to anyone again. I think 13 green, we sort of had a moment where it's like it started to really blow the wind, and at that point an umbrella is basically pretty useless because you know you use more energy trying to hold it up than you kind of save by staying dry. So the rain suit went on, and all the gloves went back in the pockets, and whatever towels we had left went back in the bag. The umbrella went away, and then we walk off the 14th tee after I hit my arm. My shot into the par three, and my caddy Johnny fell over backwards and landed on the bag, which was mildly humorous until the next hole when we pulled the umbrella out and the umbrella snapped in half in the fall. So that was kind of how good our day was going right there.
Brad Johnson's a lover of the greyhounds because King of Swing is one of his dogs who's been running every Thursday for the last couple of months. I did note with great interest, Jono, as we welcome you to the program today, that the King is not running today at Sandown Park. Is that because he disappointed the nation last Thursday when you came on? Good morning.
Good morning, Harv. Good morning, Whitey. Good morning, everyone. Yes, look, the King, I haven't had a text overnight to say that the King is running tonight. So I think we're stepping him out of Thursday racing. We might go for the pinnacle of Saturday night racing. I think that's where we want to get the King to. But look, yes, he was very disappointing last Thursday. And I know I gave him a massive rap, but I've been doing it for the last month and a half, and he's raced every Thursday. And for those that were on him early, they got great value. He had an unbelievable. I think he had a second or a third there that might have paid $7 or $8 at one stage half. So what we could have capitalized early. Yes, we capitalised early. He hasn't been great the last three runs, but we're sort of probably sitting around even now, maybe still in front from the early mail that I did give you. So if you're on early, you're capitalised. He's just probably needs a little bit of a spell, I think, the King, and just to freshen up and get himself going again. But we're wrapped with what he's been able to do for us. He's a beautiful, beautiful dog. We love him.
No, we hate him. He's a stupid dog, and he's gone. Have you got a spare room at your house? Because Whitey's going to have to move out shortly.
Yeah, I told Emma, I said, Brad's really confident with his dog, and she's been on a bit of a run. She goes, all right, let's go. The eyes lit up.
Now, Whitey, I gave you the heads up early days as well when we had some good value that it was time to get on the swing. That was the time to let the lovely know this is what we're doing. Not when the King's favourite. You don't want to be getting on the favourite. So anyway, that's where it's at. That's racing. And yeah, we're, we were a little bit flat half, and I did speak to you last week after that run. Actually, it ran at 5:09 and 5:12. My phone rang, and it was Daniel Harford on the other end.
Well, I knew the pain that Whitey was going to go through on the back of that, because we had discussions about investment strategies and involvements with spouses.
Apologies, but, boys. Look, I have got a couple of spare rooms down here in G-Town. More than happy for you to get down here and recover.
Well, I've just gone through his form. What we've worked out, Whitey, is we need to be on real early in the campaign, because from last week backwards, he's fifth, fourth, third, second, third, first. So that's going backwards from last week to the start of his campaign. We need to be on early, Jono. This is important information for our punters. Early.
I think it is. I think that's right. Harford,
he gets lactic, doesn't he?
He does. He's a big dog. He's quite large. So he needs to get going. Actually, I don't know whether it was King of Swing or New Punchline, our other pup that we have. Early days came out of the box backwards. So we thought we were going to be in trouble in the early days. He spun around. I forget which one it was, but he spun around in the box. We couldn't believe it. We had box one, prime position, waiting for the early run to see how good the dogs were. And it's come out backwards. And we're like, what has just happened? Seriously. So it was only upwards from that point.
Whitey, we need a dog. We need a dog to take on the king and take him down.
We do. I just like the fact they run every week. It's great value.
All my life tomorrow, just by the way. And more on that tomorrow morning. It's back in town. Righto, let's talk to footy, Jono, because there's been there was some outstanding footy last weekend. Just your summary of the first week of the finals and the big winners and maybe even the big loser from the first week of the finals.
Yeah, look, it was great footy. Look, we've spoken all year, haven't we, around the ups and downs of the game and how it sort of looks and how it should possibly be played. And I think we got a great taste of hopefully what, you know, we will see for the future too in terms of where the game will go. It was brilliant footy. It was tough and it was contested, which we do like, and we've said that along. But it had some great attacking flair to it as well, which I think has really got everyone up and about sort of, you know, the best teams playing that sort of way. So often we see the best teams play each other and it's just a nil or draw at the end because defensively they're so sound in the way that they set up. But that first week of the finals, it had absolutely everything that we love about the game. It had the contest. It had some big mag marks. It had some unbelievable goals. So it really was awesome footy. All across the board, I think every team walks away with taking something. Even the losers take something out of the performances from the weekend. Probably the biggest loser, I thought, was probably my old team, the Bulldogs, who had a big opportunity, I think, to really take a step forward in this final series, especially with the way everyone rated them as a footy club. And the other one was probably the West Coast Eagles, of course, playing at home against Collingwood. And they really let that one slip. They just couldn't get their game together for four quarters. Collingwood were amazing in the way that they set themselves up. And you can tell mentally, more than anything, they were in a really sweet spot. And they're a threat now for the final series, where Nathan Buckley has really put them as a footy club.
So just on your Dogs, Brad, what do you think they'll do? Because Luke Beveridge almost turned into a list manager in his press conference post the game and sort of, you know, forecast potentially some changes. Is it as simple as getting a ruckman and maybe a key forward, or do they have to do something a little bit more significant to get out of this sort of period where they're in the ladder at the moment? It can be quite dangerous, 6-10, because you're sort of in no man's land, and they've been there now for a little while.
Yeah, they have, and that's the biggest challenge for the Western Bulldogs is how do they become a top four team? Is that realistic with the list that they do have? And that's the questions that Luke Beveridge will be asking himself and the club and obviously the players, because they won the flag in 2016, and we said this way back then that they win the flag from seventh, and then from that, it had to become a top four team. How do they do that? Then they've missed finals for a few years in a row, and now they're back into that spot, as you mentioned, Whitey, sitting seventh again. So the steps have to be forward for this footy club. Otherwise, they've got to look at ways that they might have to tread water for a bit to then burst into that top four. Because we all understand, you give yourself the best chance to win flags by being top four year in, year out. Now, That's what the best clubs have done since Hawthorn and Richmond of recent times, Brisbane back in the day. Collectively as a group, they were that good consistently. So the Bulldogs aren't there yet, and they haven't been there. Even 2016 was an unbelievable final series, and we all loved it. The footy they played was amazing, but they haven't been able to step up and really compete for that top four since that period. So that's personnel. That's a little bit of style. I think they do have the personnel up forward to be able to do it, Whitey. I think in terms of the way that their style of play, I think at times gets their forwards a little bit too high, so therefore they don't have that ability. I think with what they need to do is like what Port Adelaide do with Dixon. I honestly believe Shacky is a very, very good player and can be a very good player if he's allowed to play inside forward 50. If he's to get up and down the ground, he's going to be no effect on the contest because he'll just blow up. But if he can play that Tom Hawkins type role, well, good luck to it. Maybe even that's what Josh Bruce needs to do rather than trying to get up and about and run around everywhere as well. Just compete. But, you know, there were a lot of players that were down throughout the year. They fluctuated in form. And they're the ones that Luke Beveridge will be asking questions of. Well, they had their star players. They had some excellent players throughout the year. We understand that. And Caleb Daniel winning the best and fairest was a huge result for him on the year that he had with Bont and McRae and the usuals that we speak about. Bailey Williams was an improver. Bailey Smith was an improver. But overall, there's just not enough there to get them to the top four at the moment. They're the questions that need to be answered.
Do you think, Jono, that they would be prepared with their depth in the midfield to trade one of their guns to fix a hole somewhere else?
Possibly. Yeah, I think so. And even in that last final, I sort of was having a look, and Crozier was playing forward where he played back most of the year and had that sort of impact across half back. Dunkley didn't attend too many centre bounces in the final against St Kilda due to the structure that they're obviously trying to play and the matchups they were trying to implement throughout the midfield. So he went into the midfield in the last quarter, Dunkley, and all of a sudden they start going again. So there were a few little things there that I thought that sort of went, okay, they're probably looking for different things to achieve throughout the game. Some work, some probably didn't work. But there are some players half that they will look at, they will need to look at to take that next step to being a top four team. They need to find whether that is a ruckman to help Tim English. I'm not sure whether that is the answer or where it's more collectively around the ball with another star to walk through the doors through the trade period that may allow them through the midfield to take another step and go towards that top four. I think it really is through there that they're in the forward half. I think the back half they can work through. I think they've got a good enough back six to eight that can help them get to that point. It's midfield forward that they need to work on.
Might be handed the Bombers, Josh Dunkley. Whitey?
He'd be absolutely someone that I'd be targeting. I mean, particularly through the second half of this year, Jono, where he didn't play midfield time because really Liberatore was taking a lot of his minutes in that position. That inside mid, bigger body, get the ball out to the outside, which he does so well. That's what Essendon needs. I'd be targeting him. He'd be almost my number two or three pick.
Well, they'll have plenty of picks, it seems, the Bombers, so they might be able to service that if that's, in fact, something that the Bulldogs would be open to. Jono, just on the Bombers, before we get to worrying about the games this weekend, which are going to be great to watch, don't get me wrong, what's your assessment of what's happening at Windy Hill or Tullamarine these days?
Oh, look, it's probably part of now how do you fix what's going on at Essendon. Look, that's the question that all the fans would be certainly asking, all the members that follow the footy club, even the footy world. You sort of sit there and go, okay, yeah, they've got their problems, of course, and players are leaving, players are asking for trade. There's still question marks on a couple of others as well that are out and out stars of the footy club in terms of merit and Fantasia and what decisions they're going to make over the coming weeks as well. But how do you fix the problem? You mentioned Josh Dunkley there. You go to quality. What is out in this AFL land that is quality in terms of the type of player you could get to your club? And a Dunkley sort of character is exactly, you're right, Whitey, what they would need. Now, Josh, we're not saying he's going anywhere from the Bulldogs, so Bulldogs fans, just relax with that. I suppose it's just an example of the type of player that Essendon may look at. And I go to the Brisbane model because when Chris Fagan went to the Brisbane Lions, they were an absolute, you know, rabble of a football club. Players were leaving left, right and centre. They didn't want to go to Brisbane to live and play. And now Chris Fagan and the way that him and himself and Dave Noble and a couple of others definitely have helped create an environment that becomes now a destination for players to want to go to. And so you look at what he did with getting Luke Hodge in, because of that character and that strength of character more than anything, to sort of pull into line exactly the way that a club should look on the field. So from an Essendon point of view, can they get a Ben Stratton out of retirement? Could they go to a Cade Simpson and say, hey, you know, we're not going to judge you on performance, but we just need you to come and play for a couple of years and help set us up. Is it someone, you know, of that sort of quality that they can get out of retirement, for example, to help that footy club? And then you go to sort of the administration side of things. How do they get, you know, someone to assist a Ben Rutten to create this environment? What do the players really need? Do they need a defensive type style next year, or do they need to have some freedom in the way that they play to get the love back for the game? Because if they get the love back for the game, then all of a sudden that will help their inside work within their footy club, because they're up and about, they're enjoying it, they walk through the doors thinking, yeah, we're on this week. We've got a style of football that we absolutely love. And when I look at the Bombers, they need an attacking style of flavour to start, because defensively they'll have their setups anyway. But when you look at Tippin Woody and Devin Smith and Heppel when he comes back, even Merritt through the midfield, they like to go. That's why Saad is such a huge loss. But if they had an attacking style of football, I reckon Saad makes the decision to probably stay at Essendon. So I think that's a shift that maybe needs to come, just for the players to get back, play in their best positions, really simplify it. But if they play in their best positions, they've got the best opportunity to succeed as a player. Therefore, it starts to bubble underneath that they're enjoying it. They're enjoying the environment. And then that's the slow part. That builds a strong base. Then you can build from that sort of point there. But they talk about the draft. They'll get some good kids in, no doubt. But I think they need someone, one or two players, to step in from a more experienced point of view to really assist, similar to what Brisbane have done for these younger players coming in. The other thing, and my last point with it, Brisbane drafted mates to their footy club. Can Essendon do that this year? There's a couple of guns out of the Oakley Chargers. Can they get them together? There's a couple from the Geelong Falcons. Can they get them to the club together? All of a sudden, you've got some mates that are playing together, and that bubbles underneath, similar to what Brisbane did in terms of their development over the last few years as well.
Need to give some love to Izzy McVigor, who yesterday became another Australian woman to win a WNBA championship with Seattle when they defeated Las Vegas 92-59. At the age of 21, it was only Erica D'Souza, age 20 in 2002, that's won a title at a younger age, and she joins some of the greats of Australian basketball: Lauren Jackson, Penny Taylor, Erin Phillips, of course, and Belinda Snell. As WNBA champion, she's going gangbusters, is Ezzy, and we thank her for putting the Australian hoops on the stage, on the world stage, for a WNBA championship. And there's plenty more up her sleeve, I reckon, at the age of 21. I'm sure it brought a smile to the face of Tommy Greer as well, the CEO of the South East Melbourne Phoenix, who joins us on the Breakfast Club this morning. Good morning, Tommy.
Morning, boys. Thanks for having me on.
Nice to be winning titles in the WNBA, wouldn't it, for a 21-year-old Melbourne girl?
Absolutely. And good on you guys for calling that out. I feel like it actually should have got a whole lot more media attention. Just an incredible achievement for such a young woman.
We're trying to track her down, but we've had a bit of a challenge at the moment. So she's probably celebrating. So we're going to try and see what we can do to get her on the program. But a fantastic achievement. Just like it's been for the Phoenix and the NBL. And we've spoken about that a few times on the first year. Tommy, how's year two shaping up from your perspective? And how different is it with one under the belt?
Yeah, look, it is a little bit different. It's been a wild off season, obviously. You know, like all sports, and we've seen it with the AFL and a lot of other codes. But been a lot of learning over this off season, and we feel like we're starting to now build a little bit of that momentum. Now that we've got that sort of set sort of start date of, you know, around mid January there, that we can work towards it, and we're starting to have our guys arrive in town and hit the training floor. So I'm starting to build a bit of momentum now.
How do you have to adapt your pre-season during the COVID times, protocols and timings and access to players and that sort of thing? How does it affect the way you build up?
Yeah, look, it's been crazy, to be honest. You know, generally throughout off seasons with all sport codes, it's really cookie cutter model, right? You know when the season's going to end and when free agency starts, and then when you need to get your guys into town and you start your pre-season games, and it's really just like the flow-on effect. But this one's been a whole lot different. You've got to be able to, we've had to be able to adapt pretty quickly to situations. Obviously, down here in Victoria with COVID, things have been a little bit more difficult, and our guys are on the court now, which is really good, but not allowed to contact train as of yet. So that's sort of pushing back our pre-season a little bit. But we're hoping by the time those next restrictions lift, the boys will be going at it full on from then.
Do you see it as a disadvantage, Tommy, with what's happening in Victoria compared to other states in your preparation, or do you think with the season being pushed back, it won't have any impact at all?
Oh, look, I think for the time being, it's not going to have too much impact with the season not starting till sort of mid-January there. So I think as long as over the course of this next sort of month or so, we can get to a point where the guys are training properly and full contact, that it won't have too much impact. And I guess the other side of it is it's really given all our guys a chance to work on their bodies and get all those sort of niggling injuries right. And by all accounts, all the guys are looking really good at the moment. So could be a bit of a blessing in disguise.
And from a roster point of view, where are you at there? We've spoken to quite a few clubs and the league just in regards to feeling that it might be a better chance to get players from overseas to come to Australia because of our COVID situation. I mean, we know it's not great in Victoria at the moment, but generally, compared to other countries, we're doing extremely well. Do you see that as an advantage? And have you got still spots on your list to fill?
Yeah, look, I mean, ultimately time will tell, but I do. I see it as a real advantage. And that's the way we've been going about this off-season. We're trying to remain really patient and sort of work out how the international basketball landscape sort of plays out. And the Shoot fans will have noticed that, you know, there's been a few COVID outbreaks over in EuroLeague clubs over the past sort of week or so. And so how that season rolls out over the next few months will be really interesting. And it could mean that there's a lot of really, really high-level players who come on the market over the next little while. And it'd be great to see some of those guys, you know, land down here in southeast Melbourne.
All right, let's talk some cricket. The Sheffield Shield season starts on Saturday, if you don't mind. Starts this weekend in South Australia. The hub, the bubble for cricket is in South Australia and Adelaide for the first couple of games. And Peter Siddle will be flying in from Tasmania. Doesn't even have to quarantine these days because he picked the right state to live in during a COVID crisis. And he joins us on the line. Good morning, Sids.
Good morning, guys.
Now, we're sitting here very much locked down at the moment. How much joy are you getting from being able to move around freely in life?
Without rubbing it in, it obviously has been quite good. But, I've tried to keep it pretty low-key when talking to friends and family back home in Melbourne, that's for sure.
It's a good plan. So you don't have to quarantine. You can fly straight in from Tassie on the weekend.
Yeah, so there's no restrictions pretty much for every other state. New South Wales had a little bit, I think. But for us, it was pretty much just a couple of days of sort of self-isolation in Tassie, in Hobart, just before we go. Had a test yesterday. That's about it, which is very handy.
Good stuff. Now, last time we spoke to you, you were in quarantine with an exercise bike and Netflix going berserk. How did you go getting out of that, and how have you found life in Tassie building up to this Sheffield Shield season?
Yeah, I got out of that pretty quick. Don't worry about that. As soon as I get back into the real world, I made the most of it. But obviously it has been enjoyable down here. Obviously, there was the lockdown back home. I got out at the right time, like you said. But preparation's been going well, and now it's just exciting time that we're actually going to finally play some cricket. I think that's been the biggest drag in the last couple of months, has just been, when are we going to be playing? What's going to be happening? But now it's right upon us now.
So with you going across, you play on Saturday against Queensland. So will you then stay in South Australia because you've got all those back-to-back games? Do you get to go back and come forward? How will it work out over that sort of those period of matches?
Yeah, so everyone's pretty he's based over there for the whole time, so for the full 5 weeks. Everyone's based in Adelaide. The gaps in between games, the breaks, we just stay there. So the easiest way to keep everyone as safe as possible or as COVID-free as possible so we can get the whole
well, not the whole series, but get all those games underway and played. So, nah, stay there. And, yeah, hopefully, just get a heap of cricket in, no bad weather, and we just want to be playing. So, fingers crossed that's the case.
Not really part of the plan, was it? I mean, you meant to be bowling on Belrive with the branches on the pitch and doing all that sort of stuff. You're going to play on roads over in South Australia.
No, mate. Haven't you seen what South Australia dish up the last couple of years? Green wickets for their seam bowlers. So it's nearly like playing a home game going over to Adelaide.
Okay.
And playing on the wickets over there. So the old days it used to be flat and the road, but over the last sort of 5-6 years, nice green wickets with plenty happening. So, as you know, over the years, the green wickets sometimes haven't been my most favourable. I've actually done better on the harder wickets. So it doesn't really matter what gets rolled out.
True, because it will be interesting where you're playing, because essentially there's one that's sort of in the parklands, one of the grounds, and then there's the sort of the Adelaide Oval second oval, and then Adelaide Oval. Have you had a bit of a sort of reconnaissance mission across there, or does anyone really know what you're going to get standard wise when it comes to the pitches, or you're fairly confident that it'll be okay?
No, that'll be fine. So pretty much that Park 25 they talk about, it's at the back of Karen Roll, so it's similar to like the Junction Ovals is the Karen Rolton, and then they did up all these grounds around it that we'll be playing on. But for me, it's sort of like a home game because they're the grounds that we actually prepare for when I'm over there preparing for the Strikers in the season. So,
oh, yes,
So I've played on these grounds. I've done loads of fielding. And to be fair, the actual one that is Park 25, and we play three of our four games on it, Tasmania, is... it's actually a really nice ground. It is just a genuine club ground, but it's a beautiful outfield, great wicket. So, other than having the stands and the fence going around it, it's going to be good for cricket.
I've been waiting for this one this week because we watched with great interest last Saturday night as those pesky, dirty Magpies came out squeaky clean on Saturday against the West Coast Eagles with a 1-point win in the elimination final. And Taylor Adams was one of the reasons that they did it. An All-Australian year, he's just brought up game number 150 and he's leading from the front every single week. And he's part of our team and we love him on the Breakfast Club. And he's back again. Taylor, good morning. Congratulations.
Thanks, Arf. Good morning. Good morning, Whitey. How are we?
We're going well, mate. You must be going beautifully, though, because you told us, you basically told us last week that you'd win without saying it. You basically told us you were that bullish. You spoke so positively. Your mind was really in a really good spot. And seemingly, so was that of your teammates, those minds of your teammates last week, because that was a fantastic performance.
Yeah, it was. It was, yeah, obviously one of the best wins that many of us have been a part of. It was, you know, a well-executed plan. We were really confident going into the game that, you know, we'd made a few slight tweaks and their mindset was in the right place to really take it up to them. And, you know, we thought if we could stay in the game and give ourselves a shot, then, we thought that we were a chance to run away with the win. And just so happened we were able to do that.
So, Taylor, they're talking about it being a famous Collingwood victory. And in a lot of ways it was, for obvious reasons. But because of the confidence you had going into the game, you said it was one of the best wins you've been involved in. But I wouldn't describe it necessarily as you thought it being a shock.
No, not a shock. We're really confident. We knew we had to play well. And that's the reason why it was such a great win, because we're coming up against a great team, you know, over on their home deck, as I said last week, you know, massive crowd advantage and, you know, they were able to stay at home, that sort of thing. We've been quarantining for 7 days and, yeah, you know, it's the toughest game in footy to go over and play a Perth side, you know, let alone in an elimination final. So, yeah, we certainly weren't shocked. We were really, really confident with what we could do. And we knew we had to play consistently for four quarters and that we weren't going to get the game on our terms for the full four quarters, which clearly didn't happen. You know, both teams had patches of momentum and were able to control the game for periods of time. I think the the really pleasing thing for us was we were able to stop their momentum, you know, late in the third, early in the fourth, kick a couple of goals when we really needed them, and we're able to just keep our noses in front.
So I've got two questions I'm keen to ask you. One is on the ball movement. It clearly seemed to be quicker, and we talked to you about this last week, about it seemed to have improved the ball movement in recent weeks. Was this a conscious decision to go quicker against West Coast, or has this been building that you think it needs to be part of your game against every team in the build-up to the final series?
Yeah, we've been working on our ball movement for, you know, the best part of 6 to 8 weeks. We understood that we weren't scoring probably as freely as we'd like to, or we have in the past, and we just wanted to be really confident and bold with, not bold, but really confident with the way we move the ball. There's not a whole heap of coaching around the decision making aspects of our offense, because it's really, really hard to coach. You know, we like to give our players freedom with ball in hand. Let them play on instinct and sort of see whatever the game gives them and hit that. So there was no doubt, you know, once we got the ball in the front half, we really wanted to attack their key defenders and give Coxie and Checkers and Jordy and Will Hostinelli a chance in the air to fly for their marks and if not, bring the ball to ground and let our small guys get to work and try to hit the scoreboard.
And the other question I had for you before half goes to town is just that last minute. I'd love to know what's going through your mind, because you're involved in a really important phase with your smother. You had 9 disposals in the last quarter. It was an amazing finish from you personally. But how stressed are you when it's a cutthroat final, there's less than a kick in it, and there's all to play for? What's it like?
Yeah, I don't think I was too stressed. And we were really calm, obviously, going back to that centre bounce after I kicked that goal. I think there was a minute 17 on the clock. And they'd scored 5 goals, or roughly 5 goals from centre bounce to that point. And to be completely honest, that was the only way they were going to beat us. And we knew that, as you know, the 4 guys in there, Darcy Cameron, Pendles, Adzi and myself. Darcy knew he had a huge role to play in that, because Nat knew he'd been pretty influential in that centre bounce. So just to nullify him a little bit and give ourselves a, you know, 50-50, 60-40 chance of winning the ball out of there was huge. And his contest was great. We obviously had a bit of a plan in place. We've trained being in that position before, and yeah, we're able to execute. You know, that when I got that ball coming out of the centre bounce, they would have had a couple of spares behind the ball, so you know, we had to make sure the ball was kicked along the ground so that they didn't mark it. And then Geordie's little tap to Josh Thomas was really clever. And you know, we'll meters away from sealing the game with Adzi having a shot, but yeah, everyone sort of spoke about the smother. And the way that I looked at it was, if it wasn't me in that position, it would have been another midfielder. It would have been Adzi or Pendles or another Collingwood player, because that's just what we're trained to do. We're the best defensive side in the comp, and the reason is because we'd all adhere to our roles and play the structure. And you know, I was in the right place at the right time to be able to make that play, but yeah, as I said, if it wasn't me, it would have been someone else to do that.
Rubbish. They would have sidetracked. They would have jumped out of the way. You're the only one capable of doing it. It's funny how good players find themselves in the right spot at the right time, Tay. Don't try and downplay it. You're a superstar and you're doing great things. Don't try and downplay it. It's okay. Now, but you've given us a great insight into the planning, into the depth of planning, taking on West Coast Eagles. And what I love about that, what you just said there, was there's a real element of horses for courses to the plan. Obviously, Cameron and Grundy tag-teaming Nat Nui and Allen, and probably in reverse order than most people thought, was a genius plan. But also, and I'm intrigued by the last bit you said about kicking the ball on the ground, so into the forward line, so that their intercept markers don't have a chance to do what they do. I mean, that's a great depth of plan and insight into how you prepared for that clash and were able to execute the plan, as you rightly say. When you it's such a foreign thing to kick the ball sort of on the ground. Worst case scenario, make the ball
half.
What's that?
When I say that, that was only the last play. Given that we had, most teams after, when there's 2 or 3 minutes to go, they want to get a couple of guys behind the ball. So we got our forwards to push back after the centre bounce. So, that it happened to be a 2v2 there, but if I was to go longer over Geordie or Joshy Thomas's head, there's probably a guy sitting there who's going to mark the ball as a spare. So, you can see what Mace did early.
That was the best of the Breakfast Club. If you want to hear the full interviews again, go straight to the website, rsn.net.au.